Excellent.
Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the inaugural episode of the Guest House. I'm your host, Suhail, with our co-hosts, Ahmed and Ismail. And we're going to kind of just go over who we are, introduce ourselves, and go over why we want to do the podcast and what we're going to bring to the podcast. So, again, my name is Suhail. I am the oldest of the trio here, happily married. Four boys ranging in ages from 8 to 19. I am professionally, I'm in title insurance, which Ismail doesn't know, so it's a surprise to
Yeah,
him.
I'm finding out now as we're
You know,
speaking. So how much?
which I guess most people don't know what title insurance is, so we'll say it's real estate adjacent. I also volunteer a couple of different things. I'm coaching middle school basketball. We've done Cub Scouts, soccer teams. Working on a couple of personal projects right now for the youth, and I think this podcast was going to be part of that as well. And that's my intro, and we'll pass it on to Ahmed, I guess.
So as Sahil said, my name is Ahmed, residing in New Jersey. I have some background and education in environmental policy and economics, also pursuing an MBA in marketing, which is what I do professionally for almost, or actually a little more than a decade now. But really my biggest claim to fame is being Sahil's nephew.
Well, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that. My biggest claim to fame is, oh, you're the guy married to Hanin.
Yeah.
So, you know, I guess it goes both ways.
Yeah, so I'm currently pursuing my PhD in Istanbul in Islamic history. My previous background has been in business and political science, and I grew up in New Jersey with Ahmed actually, and just looking to study more intently Islamic history and Ottoman history, to get a better understanding of our past and better understand our present. So, And what we're still building, right? working, still working on my claim to fame, but you know, hopefully I'll get some from Sahel
I think it's safe to say we're always trying to be like Ahmed, so we'll
No.
just keep that as it is. So Ahmed,
Hardly.
why did you want to do the podcast?
I mean, I think when we talked about this together in this group, as well as individually with each other, I think the biggest thing that I think we've always kind of talked about, even outside of like talking about a podcast and doing a podcast or talking about your opinions, is always like the lack of really a voice of I would say broadly the Muslim American, but kind of just the young Muslim American voice in kind of just public discourse. We obviously know a lot of imams and sheikhs who do speak at a very theological level, a very Islamic perspective, but we don't really hear or know of or really have a good sense of what the I guess we can still classify ourselves as youth.
Well, I think you two can.
Barely. Youth adjacent.
Yeah, youth adjacent. There you
slowly exiting.
go.
Yeah, slowly exiting as we all are. But yeah, I think that's kind of where or at least I hope we can kind of land at is to kind of be a voice. Again, not so starkly, but to be some part of a voice towards a specific subsect of opinion, a specific subsect of perspective, a specific subsect of kind of the Muslim American experience. So that's kind of what I'm hoping that we can kind of partake in. And the idea here is not to be yet another podcast Right. in a sea of podcasts, including even Muslim podcasts. We are hoping to offer a more nuanced approach to social and even political conversation. A lot of the Muslim podcasts
in the West and in the US particularly, focus on social topics. The ones that are political tend to lean either far to the left or far to the right. And I think there's a larger subsegment or subset of Muslims and people in general that I think a more nuanced voice between those two sides more resonating to them. And I think here is to kind of find that it's not always one extreme versus the other. And Ahmed, you and I have talked about this. The issue that we see is that whenever one extreme goes really hard one way, the other side goes to the other extreme. And however far you pull the pendulum, it'll swing just as hard the other way. And that's, you know, an issue. And I think that the majority of people, majority of Muslims in America, the majority of Americans, you can even say majority of people in the West, have a more nuanced approach to social issues and political issues that is not expressed in mainstream media. It's not expressed in political parties. It's not expressed in many of the loudest voices that we see. And I think the goal here is to bring a new, more nuanced voice to the ones that people are generally mostly exposed to, and offer some kind of alternative that would resonate more with what I believe are a larger segment of our society.
So my idea wasn't as nuanced and noble as you guys. As Ahmed knows, I've been trying to do a podcast for many years. I've asked family members, distant relatives, friends, and most of them kind of brushed it off, and some of them were too busy. And I even brought up with Ahmed a few years back, and he rejected me as he usually does.
No,
and then,
come on.
And then I came to find out that him and Ismail were prolific podcasters, and apparently I wasn't cool enough to be a part of that group.
Just before Sahil goes into his point, the prolific podcast he's talking about is a 3-episode podcast that died very quickly.
Listen, you didn't have to put that in there. We could have just left it as prolific podcasters. I'm trying to, you know, hype you guys up. But my intention really was more geared more towards youth and actually my son. The initial idea was to have my oldest son join in as well, which I think maybe, you know, we will do
join
here and there to kind of get the view of his age group as well. Obviously, me being the oldest, and then Ahmed and Ismail kind of in the middle. And with him being in college, we would have had 3 different subsects to get opinions and thoughts on different events. Also, I wanted to share something with him to kind of experience current events and be more knowledgeable of what's going on, and then maybe pick up things here and there that he can use later in life, kind of make him more successful and learn from others' mistakes and kind of be ahead of the game. So that was mostly my concern, my thought process.
Well, this ties into everything we've mentioned, because
100%.
Social issues, political issues, all this stuff, it's generally geared towards the youth anyway.
Yeah.
They're usually the most active group in political issues and social issues. So there's no doubt that this all goes hand in hand. So I don't think that your objective differs too much from what we're looking at overall.
And I think the prevailing kind of point that we're all saying is that we hope not to focus on kind of the headlines that we see day to day, but really to together kind of like explore what's happening and look at the human side of what's happening from our own perspectives, right? And I think Sahil mentioning the 3 different kind of generations viewpoints is very important in that, because obviously we all see things differently. We all, no matter what, even though we've all grown up in a 50-mile radius from each other, in our youth at least, we've had dramatically different experiences. So I think that's kind of the point, and kind of the objective.
I think also, Ahmed, when part of this podcast is kind of our debates, whenever we get together, it always ends up being a back and forth. I always think we disagree, but you always say we agree. But it
He
was
does
kind of
that
an
with me
extension
too.
of
He does
that.
that with me too, by the way. He always will argue about something. He says, "You know, we're on the same page." I was like, "No, we're not."
Yeah, it doesn't
No,
seem like it,
no, because the thing is, okay, here, I'm glad we talk about this now because
No, but hold on,
I
Ismail,
want to stop.
at least he doesn't come to your house, stand up on a kitchen chair and yell at you. I don't think you've experienced that.
Okay,
Don't let
first of
him
all,
come over
I've
anymore.
never done that.
Sure felt like it.
He's not allowed in my house anymore. That's how he got around it. No.
Okay, I wanna dispel that notion though, because I wanna before we even start talking about differences and opinions and perspectives, it's important not to get lost in the forest, right? Like we can't be lost in the forest looking at the specific trees when largely we have the same, we all usually have the same goals. And that's what I mean by we're not that far off from each other. Like
Yeah.
we all three of us, no matter what, have similar goals. And that's kind of when I say we're not far off from each other, is that's what I'm talking about. We can talk about the nuances, we can talk about the details, we can talk about the differences of our approaches, and that's fine. But we all know that we want the same end results. And I think that's what I mean when I say like we're not that far off from each other in our conversations, is we may be talking about the details, but the general aspect and the general consensus is the same. And I think that's important because that's not usually when there's a conversation, that's not usually understood, right? Like when you have a conversation with a stranger or a distant relative or even a close relative, you don't always have the same kind of goal and mindset that you're working towards, or that you're both kind of like alluding to, right? We never talk about like the end goal, but it's clear in our conversations that the end goals are maybe not exactly the same, but similar in most respects. So we may be talking about the nuances and the details, but the end goal usually is very similar.
Agreed, agreed. I mean, I think you and I have the same goal. I intend to take this podcast to millions of listeners and then kind of break off and do my own thing, like Justin Timberlake.
Oh, mine's world domination. Okay, so we're not the same
Okay,
then.
so slightly off, slightly off.
Yeah.
But no, I just want to add also my thought process was a little bit more selfish as well. I wanted to kind of learn from both of you guys as to the history of these issues and conflicts and things like that. So it was more of also me learning as well and discovering things that maybe perhaps I didn't know and also maybe our listeners didn't know either. So I think that'll help also.
Yeah, and something that everyone will soon realize is that Sahil is very humble. So he says that he'll learn from us, but for the most part, we'll probably be learning from him more often than
Yeah,
not.
I don't know about that. So I think we should kind of jump into why we picked the name that we did. So we are the guest house, and I will leave it to Ahmed to kind of shed some light on that.
Yeah, sure. So, really, the guest house comes from a poem from Rumi that kind of struck me, I would say, a few years back, in just like my search for kind of understanding more about life, I guess you can say. But I think the best thing to do is just to read it and then talk a little bit about how I perceive it. It may not necessarily be a kind of philosophical or theological viewpoint, but just the way that I've understood his poem. So I'll just go ahead and read it now, and then we can talk about it afterwards. Okay. So it starts with, "This being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. And that's where the poem ends. Obviously, English is not Rumi's first language, so you're not going to get the same oomph that you would if you read it in his language. But generally, I think you can kind of understand his perspective, right? And obviously, his poem, and this poem specifically, isn't the only poem that's talked about the human experience. And again, what we've been talking about can be distilled to the human experience. And really, it's about the mixture of emotions in everyday life, that they should be embraced, that they should be kind of held on to, and not quelled or squashed or pushed away from a person's self, whether it's anger, sadness, happiness, ecstasy, even depression. Every kind of emotion that someone has should be felt, right? As Rumi kind of alludes to, every emotion is there for a reason. It's meant to kind of teach us, shape us, push us to be who we will eventually be. It's a very, I would say, a very spiritual perspective on life. Obviously, you can look at it in a nihilist perspective, where nothing really matters, so the emotions are a stumbling block, which is a very crude way of looking at life. And I think if you were to look at life that way, then a lot of things wouldn't matter. But obviously, in an Islamic perspective, as Muslims, we don't have that kind of crude sense of life. We know that the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam has struggled. We know he went through his year of depression, or angst, you can say. We know he went through his sadness after Khadija radiallahu anha passed away. We know his daughter had her sadness after he passed away. We know that her husband, Ali, had his own share of sadness after she had passed away. You can see, like, there's like a there's always a line, right? There's always a thread of sadness, of angst. And I think there's a good poem that Ali wrote, at least is attributed to Ali, after Fatima had passed away. And he said at her gravesite, he wrote a poem. He recited a poem, and I'll just recite the poem, and then I'll have you guys talk, because I'm talking a lot. But he said, "What is wrong with me standing at the graveside saying salam to the one who has passed? The grave of my lover, but she's not responding to my greeting. My lover, why are you not responding to my salam? Have you forgotten all the intimate moments we shared between the two of us? My beloved, one responded and said, how can I respond to you? And I have become a prisoner by stones and by dirt. The dirt has consumed my beauty, and that is why I have moved on. And I have been veiled from my family and my beloved ones. Am I slammed back to you and to them, those I have left behind? Those intimate moments have now passed."
Yeah, so that was a very good interpretation. I'll be honest, when you went over the idea of the name of the podcast, I had not read that poem before. And I went and I read it. And you're right, it can be taken into many different interpreted in many different ways, from a theological perspective, from a spiritual perspective, from a literal perspective.
Yep.
And I think a lot of his writing is of that nature, right? From a theological perspective, any guest that comes into your life, whether it's an emotion, whether it's a physical person, you can learn something from them,
100%.
Right? And I would extrapolate that to, I've shared this thought with many people, is that, you know, all the people in your life, whether you like them or don't like them, there's always one or two qualities or traits that you can appreciate about everyone. And I think if you approach life in that sense, there's always going to be something to learn, whether it's a positive or a negative. You can always take away something from there. And, you know, at least that's how I interpreted a portion of that.
I think you're 100% right. I think to look at it in English literature, we know that in Shakespeare's Macbeth, the person in the play that had the most words of wisdom and the most surprising depths of wisdom was the one that was seen as the fool in the play, right? So
Right.
generally the other characters in the play saw him as a fool, but he always had the most poignant perspective on something that was happening. And to your point, Sahil, I think like that's like the point, right? Is that everything and everybody should be able to teach you something if only you were to dig a little bit deeper into what's happening.
Right, only if you embrace it in that sense. Look, I'm
Exactly.
like I said, I'm the old side of you guys, and I still like to this day feel like I don't know as much as I need to know or should know. So that was also the kind of going back to what I said before about for the youth, like if they were to open their minds and just take in the world for what it is and extrapolate these thoughts and ideas, they'd be in a much different place than at least I was when I was their age. Smile, you have any thoughts?
Not much to add on that. You guys really hit all the points. When it comes to poetry, I'm not the best interpreter of poetry, so I'm gonna just agree with Ahmed's analysis because I think he explained it very well. And I think to not segue too much off the topic of the poem, but kind of like you were talking about when it comes to interpreting Rumi theologically and ideologically. And even just in general, socially. I think this also brings us to another one of the points that I wanted to mention earlier, which is understanding ourselves and understanding the global Muslim world and the global Muslim ummah from a better viewpoint and not necessarily a certain centric viewpoint, whether it's American centric or Western centric or whatever other centric viewpoints that are prevalent, the way that, for example, Rumi has been interpreted, right? I don't know if you guys know, but Ahmed, you're probably aware that Rumi's the highest sold poet in the United States, but not for the right reasons, right? Because his poetry is romanticized outside of what he actually intended his poems to mean. So similarly, I think our podcast, in the same vein, aims to kind of, I think hopefully our goal is to kind of dispel certain ideas that might be prevalent in the Muslim American community and in the global Muslim community. And this is why also one of the things that I did want to bring central to the podcast at some point is our ability to discuss not just political and social issues, but to also discuss Islamic history, which is, again, as I mentioned earlier, something that I'm currently pursuing higher education in. So it's definitely something I'd like to get into because I think that our history is not a dead history the way many other histories are. A lot of people, if they visit certain parts of the world, and they visit historical sites, you're visiting something that's spiritually not connected to the modern society anymore, physically not connected to the modern society anymore. It's just an artifact. And I think with our history, one thing that Muslims should come to realize is that it's contiguous and it's alive and it's well. Our spiritual spaces from 1,000 years ago are still our spiritual spaces today. The physical spaces from hundreds or thousands of years ago are still the spaces being used today, whether they be mosques or endowments or even something as small as, public fountains. Everything that was part of Islamic history is part of our history today. And I think one of the biggest flaws and biggest mistakes that the modern Muslim makes is they attempt to understand politics and social issues without the framework of Islamic history. And I think that's something that cannot be separated. And I think that's something that has been separated from other histories. And so I think, not to deviate too much from what the point of the poem was, but I think it's still kind of connected, is that, we constantly have to be in touch with with our past in order to, and I know this sounds a bit cliche, but this is true, in order to understand our future and our present, and especially as Muslims, because Islam, Islamic law, Islamic history, everything about it is a living thing, not something that has died in the past and has been replaced with something else. And that's in terms of social spaces, physical, metaphysical, spiritual, all that. So that's something that I hope we bring also to this platform very prominently at some point. So just wanted to share that.
No, that's a good point. So I, not to delve into that too deeply, but something that that has been a thought recently of mine is in America. I don't know if this is if this is necessarily a Western saying, but in America there's a saying that when somebody does something great, that they say that we're standing on the shoulders of giants as like a nod to the past, right? So if somebody creates whatever, a spaceship, and they say we're standing on the shoulder of giants from of before us. Whereas I think Ismail, to your point, in Islam, there's, or at least the way that we see things, or at least I see things, is that it's very much we are lifting up the giants, right? We ourselves are the ones lifting the giants rather than standing on them. And I think that's like the perspective that it's like the inverse perspective
Right.
of like the Western of the Western viewpoint.
With that being said, obviously the third, or rather the one last item before we get into our topic that we definitely want to talk about is our goal long term as well, as we develop this podcast and as we talk about various issues. Is we want to bring on people who are far better knowledge, far more knowledgeable than we are to discuss all these different topics with us. And that means having guests on our platform. And we hope to have all kinds of guests from people in the political spectrum, history spectrum, social spectrum, imams, activists, whatever it might be, whatever is relevant at the time and whatever is relevant to the topic. So this is just something that we are looking towards. So definitely something I'm personally looking forward to. And I don't know if there's anything you guys wanted to add on to that, but I think this is something that's very important that down the road, we don't want just to be our voices because our knowledge is limited, but we want to obviously put this out to a wider audience. And in order to do that, we want to have people who are qualified and much more knowledgeable than we are to speak on the various topics and to educate us and to educate other people about the various topics that we would like to cover.
Yeah, completely agreed on that. To Sahil's earlier point, I think the point is to continue to learn and explore.
Exactly.
So looking forward to that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we present ourselves with ex as experts on any one specific field. I mean, obviously Ismail is pursuing further education, so we can attribute that to him, but personally speaking, I'm here to learn as well, and then kind of add our own nuance and thoughts and beliefs as to what's going on in the world today.
Sounds good. So, we want to spend the rest of the time to kind of just lightly discuss some of the things around the world. We have a couple things that have happened or are about to happen that I think we can talk about. And I'll defer to you guys to see which one you guys want to talk about first or what we have, if we have time to talk about both. The thing that happened just last month, almost exactly a month ago, is the liberation of Syria from the Assad regime. And since I've been living in Istanbul for some time, for a little bit now, I had the opportunity to go out to the Fatah neighborhood and kind of observe the celebrations in Fatah. Turkey is host to the largest number of Syrians outside of Syria since the start of the war. And so, seeing the celebrations that happened was very interesting to be a part of and observe. The second thing that we could potentially talk about is the incoming Trump presidency, which is less than, which is about 2 weeks away. So what kind of expectations we might have and so on and so forth. So I don't know if we could do 10 minutes or 15 minutes on each. Did you guys want to start with Trump or start with Syria?
Yeah, listen, I think you're in Turkey. I think let's start with Syria. The Trump presidency is going to be here for the foreseeable future, so I don't think there's any rush in covering that. I
Sounds
think it'd be
good.
interesting to hear your personal perspective and experiences going out into the city and seeing the reactions of the Syrians. So I think let's start from there.
So you don't
Sure.
want to announce your 2028 run right now,
No,
so
listen, this is our inaugural episode.
how
Let's save that for, episode three at least.
okay, I
If
just
you're
want
not
to
announcing your presidential run before the next president starts, you're already late to the campaign.
yeah
You know that, right?
so
So
you still have a few you still have a few days then.
you got to get on it
Okay,
soon.
I'm still working on the campaign slogan.
Yeah, this is going to be his source of fundraising, by the
For
this
yeah, a source of funding from all three of our listeners, right?
podcast.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So yeah, so I it was nice because I went we were following everybody around the world was following the rapid takeover or recapturing of Syrian cities by the rebel forces over the previous week and a half prior to the fall of Damascus. And so when I went to sleep the night before, the rebel forces were on the outskirts of Damascus. And so it was basically any hour now that we would hear some kind of announcement that Damascus had fallen. So for me, I had woken up, it was a Sunday, I had woken up around 9 a.m. Damascus had fallen to the rebels maybe only a few hours before. And I live in a neighborhood in the outskirts of Istanbul called Başakşehir, which has a very large Arab and Syrian population. And then there's also Fatah, which is in the heart of Istanbul, which has probably the largest concentration of Syrians in Istanbul. So I decided to go there. So I went there that morning. And by the time I got there, there was a huge celebration at Fatah Mosque, which is the historical mosque in Fatah neighborhood where Sultan Mehmed the Conqueror is buried. And I've been there many, many times, and it's in the heart of where the Syrians are. If you walk out from one of the gates of Fatah Mosque, you'll see just Syrian shops for several streets. So it's a very active Syrian hub, and you'll see the mosque in its courtyard, and everything is always very lively with kids and families hanging out. So we went there, and that's where all the celebrations were taking place. And people were gathered in front of the mosque in the courtyard, celebrating. And I just kind of walked around, and it's very, very joyful, almost like, almost similar. Closest thing I could think of, if my memory serves me right, is the Arab Spring, which I wasn't in the Middle East at the time that it happened. I was in the US, but even in the US, with the Arab populations, the Arab Spring was a huge deal, as it was kind of happening country by country.
Well, we were in college at that point when that was happening. I mean,
Right, yeah.
I remember Mubarak was the whatever fell, whatever we want to
Yeah.
call it. That was there was like a sense of relief, definitely.
Yes. Yes. And it was a big deal because I think everybody thought that if Egypt falls, or if the Egyptian government were to step down in exchange for democracy, that this would resonate or reverberate around the Arab world and that there would be significant change. So I think that was very interesting, and it was a very exciting time. Everybody was in like, very hopeful feeling and emotion. And I think here it was the same, but I think immediately there was kind of this undertone of doubt, even you could say naysayers of or even unfortunately there has been for many years Assad apologists and other similar groups that were trying to undercut this. And then you also have a lot of people who are old enough to remember the Arab Spring and the eventual, I don't like to call it failure because everything that has been happening since is still a result of the Arab Spring, but the immediate failure of the Arab Spring. And so I think people always constantly remember that. And one thing I want to point out that people don't seem to notice is the most cautious people about the future of Syria are the very same Syrians who are celebrating it the most, because they're the ones who are the most invested, they're the ones who understand the situation the most, and they're the ones who are aware of what could eventually happen. All these kind of naysayers that are going around and saying, you know, but you free, what about this and what about that, and the Americans and the Israelis, they are the Syrians themselves who are involved with retaking Syria or coming back to Syria or celebrating the fall of Assad, are the ones who are most keenly aware of the how this could go wrong. But I think they deserve, at least at the very minimum, a day to celebrate the fall of one of the most, arguably the most brutal regime in modern Arab history. And I'm not going to get into the details, but we've all been hearing the stories. And if you've been following events in Syria for years, you'll know that this is not new. I mean, I've come across testimonies from people who fled Syria, who were prisoners over the past many years, who are talking about some of the most brutal things that they've gone through. So, you know, I think that it was is very warranted for Syrians to be celebrating the way that they were. And I think they deserve that. And they're also going to be the ones who are going to be most cautious going down the road in the future. And so, you know, for their moment that they were celebrating, they were, you know, we were out in the streets. And I even went out to the shops, and I saw, you know, many of the shop owners were giving out free coffee, free dessert, all this kind of stuff. But Mashallah, it was a very beautiful environment. It was very optimistic, very hopeful. And I think a lot of what we're seeing over the past few weeks is mostly, I think, good signs. And I think many Syrians are invested in going back home to rebuild their country. And I think that's something that has to be noted. I
So,
got, yeah, go ahead.
I was gonna jump in right there real quick with a question. So, and obviously this is just a primer. We're just hitting on this topic just because it just happened, and we'll kind of have another episode on this. But just to
Yeah.
kind of touch on what you said was about them being cautious. So, what is it specifically do you think that they're being cautious about or apprehensive about? One, and two, out of the people that you spoke to or ran into. Are they genuinely thinking about going back and reestablishing, or have they immersed themselves in the Turkish society and now this is their home? What's your takeaway on that?
So, in terms of what they're cautious about, I think there's a number of factors. Obviously, the country has gone through a decade and a half of civil war. So, the amount of rebuilding that has to be done is immense. And whether that's whether the capabilities of the Syrian people would be enough to make to realize a successful rebuilding of the country, I think is one thing that they're cautious about. But I think they're very optimistic because, again, there's one thing that people haven't realized is in the past decade and a half, Syrians have gone outside of Syria and have attained education and work experience and business experience in places like Turkey, in Germany, in the US, and even in Egypt and in many other places. And so they're now able to bring these expertise, whether it's medical expertise, engineering expertise, business expertise, whatever education they might have done, and bring that back and help rebuild the country. And this is in a country where a lot of the stuff was not accessible to the at least to the way it should have been under the Assad regime. They've really clamped down on many aspects of civil society. So that's one thing, I think. And then the second thing, obviously, is the political aspect of who's going to try to get a piece of, you know, the pie, basically. Because we've seen, obviously, Israel is already trying to occupy certain parts of Syria, bombing critical weapons and air bases and such. We know that obviously the United States never leaves anything alone in the Middle East. Iran, we don't know if they're, you know, gonna cut their losses or not. You know, there's a lot of actors at play. Turkey, who's heavily invested in Syria as well, although they might seem more friendly, and maybe they're received in a more friendly manner, but they're still a player that you have to deal with, and they still have their own interests that they want. So I think understanding the various political factions outside of Syria, as well as the various political factions inside of Syria, because there's also a question of consolidating all the rebel forces
Groups, yeah.
into a single army, which many of them have agreed to. But again, is that going to be the case? Is that going to be easy to apply? So there's all these various factors, which again we can get into more detail in a full episode. But that's one thing. In terms of how Syrians are feeling, I talked obviously to a number of people, but I obviously the people who I've talked to are not is not like a scientific sample, but there it's mixed. It's obviously a mixed bag. A lot of Syrians have integrated well within Turkish society, and many of them have struggled. In Turkey, there's you get a mix. There's you have a large segment of Turkish society that doesn't want them. It doesn't treat them as well. There's a lot of racism, but there's also a huge segment of Turkish society that has been very receptive to them, that has accepted them, that has allowed them to integrate into their communities. So I think it just depends on each Syrian's individual experience, and also even the ones who've had good experiences, whether it's in Turkey or elsewhere, they still their home is their home. So I think they're going to want to go back regardless. Many of them have been saying that they want to go back, and I think there's some evidence to this because the Hatay border in southern Turkey is already in the first week was already filled with thousands of Syrians lining up to go back into Syria. So there is a large segment of the Syrian refugee population that is interested genuinely in going back to Syria and to continue their lives there. And there are some who probably want to go back for short-term and long-term visits. And then you probably have some who probably might not want to go back at all. It just really depends. It's hard to say. I'm not sure if any reporting was done on this. It might be too soon. But the sense that I've been getting from most people that I've talked to is they do want to go back. Whether they will is a whole other story. But if Europe has their way and they're making this decision easier for many Syrians, as they've already been cutting or accept not decline no longer accepting asylum applications almost the next day after the liberation of Syria. So many people might not even have a choice but to eventually go back.
I think there's also like from some reporting that Al Jazeera has done, there's also it seems like a generational divide as well, where the younger Syrians who really don't remember or weren't born in Syria, again, to Ismail's point, it's been a decade and a half, so those that haven't been born in Syria or haven't been back since they were very young, don't know a Syria other than what it's been portrayed in on the news. So their parents remember the Syria before I guess the war. But it's very stark generational divide, I think also.
Yeah, listen, I think you guys really hit it on the head when kind of going back to what our premise of the podcast is. No story is just black and white, right? Like Ismail said, there's so many different factions within Syria, outside of Syria. There's so many factors that are in play. It's a very nuanced topic, right? So obviously we're going to have a separate episode just to kind of go over the different aspects of it, the different factions, the different roles of countries and individuals. So I think you explained it perfectly. There's a lot to the story than just one way or the other.
Right. One thing that I'm hoping, because I am perhaps too much, but I think probably not, but I am very optimistic about what we've seen happen in Syria, because there's still one of the issues that we have as Muslims is kind of this long-term thinking. And we see a lot of negative things happening around us, and we forget that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala can manifest overnight a completely different outcome. Almost every political pundit, analyst, whatever you want to call them, that I've listened to over the past year has been talking about accepting a sort of status quo in Syria, where Assad controls a portion of the country, and the rebels and the Kurds and Turkish administered areas control the other half of the country. And there was almost like a sort of acceptance that this would be, it would hold that way, and there's a new reality. We'd have to accept that Assad's never going to go. And sort of overnight, almost of a week and a half, we see the ending of a 54-year-old regime. And the reason why I'm pointing this out is because we're currently approaching a year and a half on a genocide in Palestine and Gaza specifically, but also in the West Bank. I don't think we should exclusively label it as something that's going on in Gaza. Are suffering to a pretty bad degree as well. And I think that we can see, if we can understand how things can change quickly, and this is not the first time in history this has happened. The Arab Spring was another example of this, and there's many other examples before that of things that have changed very quickly, then we should be persistent and consistent in our activism, in anything that we do for the sake of the Palestinians or any other cause, with the hope that it can change all of a sudden very quickly. And there are random factors that can come up and contribute to that. So I think the reason why I'm pointing this out is because I feel that what we see in Syria is something that can has greater reverberations in the region. I don't think this is exclusive to Syria. This is a bigger deal than a lot of people are making it. And I think this is something that we should really pay close attention to. And I would also underscore the relationship between Syria and Turkey, that this is also significant, because the Turkey's a very crucial player, obviously, in the Middle East, and I think the role that they have in Syria is very important, and I think they're unique in that. They shouldn't be lumped in as people who are interfering, like the US and Israel and Iran and those players. No, this is, I think, for the most part, a force for good and can have a very positive impact. And again, there's things I want to get into detail about that on, but I'll save it for a different time. But I think this is something that we can look at as potentially a new version of another Arab Spring or some other Arab Spring. And again, we've seen historically that the liberation of Palestine comes through the liberation of Syria and also Egypt. And this was the case with both Sayyidina Omar and with Salah ad-Din al-Ayyubi. And so perhaps no different this time as well, that we could see the liberation of Palestine through these similar factors.
I want to touch upon something that you mentioned very, very briefly. I completely agree that Allah can change things overnight, but I think it's important to know that this isn't an overnight change.
Yes, yes.
To the point earlier, this is a byproduct of the Arab Spring, right? And that I don't want to put notations on things, but generally, if you denote something and it doesn't happen within a year, that doesn't mean it's a failure, right? So things take time to ruminate, to get to a place where the opportunity is there to take advantage of it. And I think this is what's happened, right? I mean, I think a lot of the reports that have come out is that they were looking to control a certain re region, and then once they went, they realized the whole thing, the whole country was open, right? So that's not something that was done overnight. That was because of continued persistence, continued view of things that are developing, things that were happening in the region, the weakening of Russia, the weakening of Iran.
Lebanon.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a lot of other things that were happening. It happened suddenly, but it didn't happen overnight. And I, not not
Yeah,
to not
13
to
years
not,
of 13 years of rebels building up to this point.
right.
But I'm saying the point
Exactly.
is the
It's
tide
really
shifted for them because they were persistent
100%.
for so many years. The tide shifted for
Exactly.
them in the most
And I
unexpected,
think that's the point that I want to make sure that we highlight, is that with persistence and patience comes victory.
Absolutely.
Right. So it may happen suddenly, but it didn't happen overnight. Right. The people who are paying attention, who will start to pay attention again, may see it as an overnight success. I mean, we know even in business, right? Like all these people are overnight successes. No one just is an overnight success. They've done the work beforehand to be put in a position to take advantage of what's happening in the industry or ecosystem that they've found themselves in. So I think that's like the point I just wanted to highlight.
Absolutely, yeah, I agree.
Well, I think we're probably winding down, but we did mention Trump earlier. He's obviously his more America first approach may actually benefit the Syrians more than and to this one, to your point, the Turkey probably too, more than we originally thought.
Yeah, I was actually thinking that as well, that, you know, obviously this is not an endorsement of Trump, but the reality is that the first time around, Turkey benefited greatly from Trump being in office. They took advantage of a lot of things, from his incompetence, if you want to call it that, or from his unwillingness to take the U.S. deeper into conflict in the Middle East. And he has expressed similarly the same lack of interest to delve deeper into these kinds of conflicts. And to Turkey's credit, they tend to play their political cards very well. One example of this, by the
in the
way,
vacuum that they're in, yeah.
In the vacuum that they're in. And one quick example, just show you, which was also a factor into how that led to the rebels being able to take over, was they had a conference of some sort with the Russians and the Iranians. This was literally just a few weeks before liberation. I think it was in November or October. And in this discussion, they were trying to reach an agreement about basically a final setup for Syria, I guess. And one of the things was that Turkey kept stipulating over and over, and was very persistent about stipulating, that if anything were to happen militarily in the country, that no party, meaning Iran, Russia, Turkey, would get involved militarily. And they kept stipulating this over and over. And in the beginning, they were disagreeing, and eventually the Russians and the Iranians agreed to that stipulation, which might also help explain the reason why, I mean, in addition to all the other factors in terms of Russia dealing with the Ukraine war and all these other factors, but another factor into why Russia didn't step in to save Assad in the last minute. And again, they were cutting their losses because Assad was becoming a liability. And there's a number of other factors, but this was also a bit of a stroke of, you know, political genius, if you want to call it that, on Turkey's part, to ensure that they didn't know this was going to happen, but it played in their favor. Because, you know, if hypothetically Russia were to get involved, then that would allow for Turkey to also provide military assistance. But they basically agreed to the stipulations to just say basically no external military support, which would explain Russia and Iran's
has that been confirmed though, that Turkey didn't know?
There hasn't been any external confirmation. There, I don't think anybody knows for definitively. Obviously, Turkey's official stance is that they didn't know, but then they quickly endorsed it. So,
I
find it difficult that Turkey would not be aware of like a major move like that, especially because they've been heavily supporting the rebels. But also, I think what I do think is true is that I think the rebels planned this and executed this without the assistance of Turkey. But I think perhaps Turkey might have been aware, but I do think that the rebels did plan this and execute it on their own. Perhaps Turkey knew.
Yeah,
Turkey,
I mean,
but they didn't jump in.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't.
Because
I
again,
didn't
if it failed, then it would fall back on Turkey and bite them.
Yeah, yeah. So, I didn't mean to suggest that Turkey was like part of it, but for them to negotiate that in these talks suggests that there was intel, or at least they knew something was going to happen. Like you don't. Yeah. Again, if you're not, no one thought that this would happen, regardless of if they knew they would advance or not. There's no way Turkey thought that Damascus would fall.
Yeah,
at least without extreme optimism, and having that in part of the conversation seems like it was this is the only way they could have Damascus fall is if nobody intervened.
Right, that's kind of the point. Yeah, exactly. You want to?
All right. So I think that's the podcast for this episode. We want to thank you all for listening and joining us on this journey, which I hope that will be a long journey. And we hope that you join us next time as well. Until then, assalamu alaikum.